Blog Talk Radio.
Companion. It's June 1st, 2014, I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. Thanks for joining me. It's an interesting day. We have the 152nd day of the year. Hard to believe we're screaming through 2014 at this kind of pace. Here in this part of the world, we're struggling to get away from a really tight grip that winter had on us for so long. It still lets us know that it's around, but bright weather brings out the best of us. And we're looking forward to summer solstice, the first day of summer. So I guess we have nothing really to be too anxious about. The growing season seems to have changed around us. Hard not to recognize that. The ground has been so cold, and farmers are concerned that they need a bit of heat in the ground to get their seeds growing. The glaciers are melting much faster than anyone could have ever imagined. So we're only about a decade away before there won't be summer ice in the Arctic. So that means that. Have at it, boys and girls. It's a different world around us. The exploration, the mapping out the floor of the Arctic Ocean for oil exploits is already occurring, just like it did in other parts of the world. Just remember, 20,000 years ago on the spot where I am, just 20,000 years ago, would be covered with a layer of ice about 8 kilometers, 9 kilometers thick. So, and that began to recede. And I say that because, it was only to your right, for all you scholars out there, you're quite right, 10,000 years ago, this area would have been, the ice would have receded. So I would have been in the land where all the ice pulled away. So there you have it. We've got solstice coming up. Mark this one on your calendar. It's a doable event. 6:51 a.m. on the 21st of June. So that's reasonable. And that's an interesting event. The ancients recognized it for what it was. Important recognition of soul. In fact, the name comes from is Latin, one of those words that it's a composition, solstitium, the soul for the son, of course, and stitium, which means in Latin to stop. So you can work that into your evening conversation and alarm and amaze everybody around you at the table. We're going to add a little bit about today's show about Masonic composers. Today we'll look at Gilbert and Sullivan. They were Victorian era writers and composers, and they created work together. And they've actually we know their work as comic operas. And they did 14 of them. Some of the more famous, of course, is the HMS Pinafore, the Pirates of Penzance, and the Mikado. Interesting for us because they were both Masons. They did take a shot at Masonry in one of their plays. It's a parody of a lodge, and it's in their operatic called The Grand Duke. So if you're inclined that way, and you want to expand your horizon, and you want to see what in Victorian era librettist and composer Gilbert and Sullivan were up to, it's always been something that's been around colleges and high schools and university drama clubs, because it's very lighthearted. And I'll give you a sample of that music in just a second here. The three most famous, of course, of each are MS Pinafore, Pirates of Penzance, Mikado. So we're going to do a little bit from none of those. I know that William Gilbert was a member of Makar's, M-A-C-H-A-R, Makar's Lodge, 54 in Aberdeen, Scotland. And I think... Arthur Sullivan was a member of Central Lodge, but I have to I had more difficulty finding information about him to share with you. With true to form, Gilbert died tragically in 1911. It may well have been his Masonic leanings that caused his death. He jumped in to save a drowning woman, which he did. And he died of a heart attack. Good fella. Long remembered, eh? So so we're going to play just a little piece. This is from the Pirates of Penzance. It's the song called The Major General. And you can see that these fellas had their tongue firmly planted in their cheek. Nothing was safe from their pens. But that was the Victorians. This was when things were lightening up quite a bit, and you'll see for yourself.
Monsters, dare your pirate caravansary proceed against our will to wed us all. Just bear in mind that we are wards in chancery, and father the major general.
We better pause or danger may befall. Their father is a major general.
Yes, yes, he is a major general.
Yes, yes, I am a major general. For he is a major general.
He is a major general.
It is a glorious thing to be a major general.
It is. Hurrah for the major general. Hurrah for the major general.
Same as the Pirate King tune.
I am the very model of a modern major general. I'm information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England and I quote the fact historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I am very well acquainted too with matters mathematical. I understand equations both of simple and quadratical. About binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news.
Lot of news. Got it.
With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
Many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. Many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. Many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
I
I'm very good at integral and differential calculus. I know the scientific names of beings and animals. In short, in metals, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I am the very model of a modern major general.
In short, in metals, vegetable, animal, and mineral. He is the very model of a modern major general.
In fact, when I know what is meant by Mamelon and Ravelin, when I can tell at sight a Mauser rifled from a javelin, when such affairs as sorties and surprises I'm more wary at, and when I know precisely what is meant by commissariat, when I have learned what progress has been made in modern gunnery, when I know more of tactics than a novice in a nunnery, in short, when I've a smattering of elemental strategy. You'll say I better meet the general of seven statues. Unlucky and the venturi has only been brought down to the beginning of the century, but still in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern major general.
Can you do it one more time?
Certainly.
Can you do it really fast?
What? In fact, when I know what is meant by man alone and reveling, when I can tell the side of my other right or wrong and reveling, when such a face is ordered and the price I'm aware of, and when I know precisely what is meant to come in favor. Oh, when I have learned what practice has been made in modern gallery, when I know more of practice than the novice in the nunnery, and show when I'm a smattering of MML strategy, or say that I'm a general of never. Run a horse!
Got it? yeah, they took a run at all the sacred cows, reminding us all, you know. I guess it's a playful way of reminding us that you never know what happens to people when they gain a little power, but Lord Acton reminded us that. Said Lord Acton, power, no, wasn't it? Power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts. No, that was out of Shakespeare and Macbeth, wasn't it? Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. it's a gentle way of saying it. You know, it's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, actually. Which is the way a lot of plays in times past, and I think still, allow us to examine some of the, you know, the more difficult questions that face us today. Things that we find difficult to resolve within our culture. Here in Canada, we are stretching our arms around people from a number of different cultures, and we're patient. Within time, they will all be part of this nation, a modern, a composite nation, I guess. But with the best of the cultures of everywhere else, just like that sounds like Rome. That sounds like, you know, where that sounds like Genghis Khan. That sounds like China. History has been very kind to countries that have this kind of world outlook, but it doesn't really say that, history doesn't tell us that everybody was jumping up in town completely aware of the big picture and happy about it. So sometimes things go on in spite of us, don't they? Today, I wanted to get back to talking to you about Fantasia, which I thought was, if I was breathing very deeply about the idea of composing time. This is a shout out to all of the parrot heads of that are Freemasons, and I know there's a few of you out there that do tune us in. Jimmy Buffett fans. Life's too short to. I know the stern faced people out there will be stern personalities and temperaments will find this heretical, but life is short, and you've not been able to demonstrate that being stern is the only way to make a contribution. Certainly, our brothers Gilbert and Sullivan allowed us to laugh at ourselves, and I would say significantly make a contribution. In a time when we have to learn to search and trust ourselves and our own judgments. You know, it's interesting. Over the past 100 years, communities have abandoned the elements of health and replaced them with a car. Interesting people we are. Many no longer believe it is possible to create a lifestyle not dependent on a vehicle, one in which everything is within walking distance. Can you imagine? We regionalize where we work, where we shop, where we play, where we live, and where we die. Our natural lives became alienated in an artificial environment. It didn't stop there. Sustainable family farms were pushed aside by agribusinesses. This is the year of the family, the week of the family farm, by the way. We have stopped laughing at those convincing us to protect the environment. Remember those? They must be ridiculous, chaining themselves to trees. Bloody obstructionists. And for what? Protecting our rivers and protecting our streams and our air. We no longer mock science that shows the truth. We still have a hard time with it, though. The way many of us were raised to believe mankind could dominate the environment, is this the final chapter? Is that it? The belief that we were taught was completely baseless, and now we're reaping what we've sown. Sad. Faced with this knowledge, what else can a good man do but live within his sphere, able to calm his thoughts? Remember the quote, if you meet a man who, finish it yourself. He controls and affects what he can, and if he has any insight, learns that some things are beyond his reach. How different it is for a man to live isolated, embracing a value system hundreds of years old. Speaking about Masons, than a man who feels he does not fit. Robert Heinlein told us about him, called it in his book, A Stranger in a Strange Land. Lodges were never intended to be mystery schools. They are tarnished old beacons in need of repair and replacement, but visible in every community and serving an important task. They are beacons not of safety, but about opportunity, a metaphorical light in the darkness to attract a particular type of man, curious about a serious fraternal experience, bright enough to appreciate philosophical reinterpretation of perception. Becoming the temple of craft masonry is the first step. That's you. That is you. I've fallen down the rabbit hole, brethren. And I think what I've been seeing and reading and gathering from the history of Freemasonry has awakened me in a way. Freemasonry isn't about grand lodges. Freemasonry was there first. Those basic ideas of liberty and equality were there before there were lodges and constitutions. We know that. If we look generally at the first form of Grand Lodge, we knew that it was 3 years later that they put out a call for a constitution to be written. It existed. Freemasonry existed. The ideas existed. And Freemasonry was practiced well before that day in, what, December 24th in 1717. Well before that. We have records of that, 16th, 15th century. Don't get me wrong. It would be ridiculous to think that we ever could function without Grand Lodge. That was a way for us to identify and make the practices, the ideas, make it able for us to communicate, to connect, to make them coherent. Make them coherent. We needed structure. It's not to say it's better than having small pockets of men conducting their work and their lives. Not to say that. That has always been the case. That is where the alchemy of Freemasonry occurs. In your heart, in the individual's mind, or with the help of his mates, watching and listening to them and their mistakes and their successes, their achievements. Self-improvement is a matter of learning to respect yourself. A Hindu would think that that what you're doing is you're respecting God when you respect yourself. It's if we take these, continue on this path, it suggests that what has been missing is more than the Master Mason's word, that we can define exactly what that is now, I think. Want to know the secret? Of course you do. You know it. You see it already. The secret is that the work goes on within each and every man alone. That Freemasonry is, again, that atmosphere. It's, if you will, a big laboratory for experiment where we find a very rich environment pouring in on us from many, many different directions. And we're given to believe that great men have been there before us. I'm not talking about our propensity to name drop, like I did today with Gilbert and Sullivan. But I think it's important that the beacons came into existence because Freemasonry was not of one generation, that we want to be able to perpetuate the learning and the opportunity for future generations. And maybe it took the randomness out of it when we created Grand Lodges, but it also created a protection and the beacons. Tarnished or not, they're very, very important to our existence. Now that some will go, it's no longer needed. Once upon a time, we had lighthouses in a lot of points of the world that don't have them anymore. It's not to say there aren't perils, but we have different ways of detecting those things today. But there are places where the beacons are carefully maintained because the danger, no matter what, is so great that we need to be able to warn the unsuspecting. The work, then, isn't esoteric. The work is introspective. The work is contemplative. Running a good meeting has never been, I think, of any historic merit. Ever. When we look at anything historic, even about our own history, we want to know what he did, what we did. Because through those acts, it begins to tell us about the people, the meaning, who they were, and what kind of people they were, what values they held sacred. Think about your own minute books. Pretty bleak, pretty bleak. No content, down to the basic governance elements. Was the meeting held? Yes. On this date, between this time and this time, it opened here, it closed here. Ad nausea, we got it. And we wonder, is that all there is? We wonder why so many men are taking demits. I just find that just staggeringly dull. We know why. We know why. We have put an emphasis on the wrong syllable. And we're very glib. Very, very glib about it. Even worse. Hmm? Blinkered and blind with rhetoric that doesn't work. And the rhetoric is, we've always done it that way. Well, no. That really depends on how far back in history you go. So if you read any history, in fact, you go back in the history of Freemasonry, this isn't the way it was done. We were stepping into a select atmosphere because we were demonstrating a need and a desire. A desire to learn, to define ourselves as serious-minded people. Not everybody has to do that to be serious-minded. We know that. But over the years, we've compressed history. We're composing time by looking at it like we do with a pane of glass. If we look at it from the side, it's transparent. But if you look at it from the edge, it's dark blue. We compress time when we look at our time from the edge. We weren't great men in every lodge or in every era. That simply wasn't the case. But from time to time, there were men who we could recognize, not because of their ego, not because of their ridiculous ambitions, but because they made contributions to the world around us that weren't self-serving. How many of the schemes and ideas do we hear offered out there that are embarrassingly self-serving? We're not being very generous if that's the motivation. But by God, perception is reality. And if you ask, you'll hear people say that. We seem to be very self-serving. We don't like it, so we stop asking the question. Huh? What's that say about us? It's called denial. So we're not going to turn this great big ship around. I don't think we should. But the people on the decks can open the books and talk with each other, read, question, as we should. Nowhere in your obligations is it said, I will always blindly follow whatever pablum is handed to me. Not once, is it? But we know that our Grand Lodge at times seems to be rattled, sensing the potential for seismic activity when questions are being raised. My goodness, where is the confidence? Is that all we have? A reaction into and a sternness, that's all we've got. That's the way we handle our doubters, the malcontents and the whiners. How do you stop that from being the cacophony? Well, you put up a quiet sign in the library. If you want to do that, go somewhere else. Simple. If you want to complain, if it has some form and content to it, bring it forward. Bring it forward in the proper form. If you're belly aching to belly ache, shut the hell up. A little bit more about that rabbit hole. If we do this, then we're looking at ourselves as the temple. And we're looking at lodges as the inside of our minds. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the lodges that are stripped down to a basic handful of repeated symbols. It's like every boy has to wear the same shirt. So we all feel that we belong. Well, we've outgrown that. We've outgrown it. Really have. I'm too old to do that. And I'm not... Yeah, I wish, I guess, it would be easier if we could just be... We could all dumb it down and don't ask questions. That's all it takes. That's all it takes. We can... Once you replace negative thoughts with positive ones, you'll start having positive results. That came from Willie Nelson. Let's all laugh at Willie. And here's another person we can laugh at. The gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent for absorbing positive knowledge. What a fool. Albert Einstein. You know, in order to carry a positive action, we must develop here a positive vision. Where do we get these people? What is this positive attitude? Now that one came from the Dalai Lama. Hard to believe. How do we function with such loose talk around us? Let's get back in line and shut up. Let's be better. Better little whatever widgets. If you are given a chance to be a role model, I think you should always take it because you can influence a person's life in a positive light. And that's what I want to do. That's what it's all about. Live a good life. Strive for that. How do we get... Oh, Tiger Woods said that. It's easier if we can just mock things that we don't like or find the salacious element in a person. Something that satisfies one of our own primitive cravings. That nice part of our limbic system. Nothing like it. And we can all sit up and mock together. It makes us feel very righteous. Freemasonry really doesn't allow us to do that. Really doesn't. That's my gift. I let that negativity roll off me like water off a duck's back. If it's not positive, I didn't hear it. If you can overcome that, fights are easy. Another crazy man. That came from George Foreman. Wow. Alexander Pope said, the most positive men are the most credulous. Just amazing. When you think about people from different walks of life, giving us information, giving us insights. So pick your place. Not one size fits all. You are the unique being, that culmination of the history and that you carry in your genetics and in your soul. Well, let's go on a little bit, talk about something that's righteous and makes us feel really, really that we're getting on with the task. I needed to talk to you about some of the ancient landmarks. But you okay to do that? Or would you rather listen to a little bit of music? We'll come around to that in a minute. I've got on deck, we've got Billie Holiday awaiting us. And, man, that's very poignant. There's a poignancy to Billie Holiday singing at a time when she ought to have known her place better. All those prejudices and biases are shamefully around us. And so it's important to keep those things in mind while we're trying to understand our own nature. So we'll listen to Billie Holiday in just a little while. I wanted, we started to talk a bit about the landmarks. Some interesting things happening. Boy, I hope you guys you brethren and guests, are feeling really, you've given some thought to the Sankey lecture. I think if you begin to realize what's happened, you're going to be quite pleased that you were around in this period. Other places in the face of the earth tried to have sustainable conferences, big ticket that would draw on people from around the world. I think that's brilliant for the scholars to get together. The best work and research going on in Freemasonry isn't happening within Freemasonry. It's happening in the outside world where scholars are looking at the phenomena of Freemasonry. And of course, we can't hold a candle to that. Cultures around the world recognize that the universities is where we pull together, create a gravity that pulls together our brightest minds. Oh, get over yourself. Yes, there's a lot of different ways to be successful without being well-educated. But being well-educated, self-educated, the idea of going through all of that training is to learn how to set your own personal standards exceptionally high, how to study, how to think, how to read, how to write. You can do that on your own, of course. Lots of people do. But you can also take it for granted if it's been around you all your life. It's like taking the air for granted or taking the cleanness of the water for granted. You don't do that anymore when there's not enough air that's clean and you have to search long and hard for clean water. No, everybody stops laughing. Well, we don't need the calamity to stop laughing at ourselves. Let me talk a little bit about we'll get back to Ms. Holiday. She wasn't born that way. We'll talk to you about that in a second. Eleonora, that's me. It's the name she was born with. We left off at talking. Give you seven of the landmarks. Remember, we were actually talking about them and had them defined in this interesting work volume on created for a liberal Masonic education. That's liberal simply means starting point. You want to use a broad brush, right? Broad brush education, because you never know what those things that were less important to you today will mean tomorrow. So here we're looking at things out of time. Remember the definitions of landmarks. These are custom. It was a custom to mark the boundaries of lands. And remember that? And the first requisite of a custom or rule of action to constitute it a landmark is that it must have existed from time whereof the memory of man runneth not to the contrary. It's so old there's nobody around to whine and complain about it. We're never sure where it came from. There's no ego to stroke to say, oh, that idea came from Dale. They're just ideas that stand by themselves. The prerogative here, let's start. The prerogative of the Grand Master to make Masons at sight is a landmark which is closely connected with the preceding one, which is the prerogative of the Grand Master to give dispensation for the opening and holding of lodges. There has been much misapprehension in relation to this landmark, which misapprehension has sometimes led to a denial of its existence in jurisdictions where the Grand Master was, perhaps at the very time substantially exercising the prerogative without the slightest remark or opposition. The next is the necessity for Masons to congregate in lodges. That's another landmark. It is not to be understood by this that any ancient landmark has directed that permanent organization of subordinate lodges which constitutes one of the features of the Masonic system as it now prevails. But the landmarks of the order always prescribe that Masons should, from time to time, congregate together for the purpose of either operative or speculative labor, and that these congregations should be called lodges. Formerly, these were extemporary meetings called together for special purposes, and then dissolved, the brethren departing to meet again at other times and other places according to the necessity or circumstance. But warrants of constitution, bylaws, permanent officers, and annual arrears are modern innovations. We've always done it that way? I don't think so. Modern innovations wholly outside the landmarks. Ouch. And dependent entirely on the special enactments of a comparatively recent period. Those damn ancients and moderns, hey? Ah, yes. That's an interesting period, you think? That the old and protected were the modern? But next one, give that one some thought. The next one is that I have here is the government of the craft, when so congregated in a lodge by a master and two wardens, is also a landmark. Makes sense? A congregation of Masons meeting together under any other government as that, for instance, of a president and vice president or a chairman and sub-chairman would not be recognized as a lodge. The presence of a master and two wardens is an essential to the valid organization of a lodge as a warrant of constitution is at the present day. The names, of course, vary in different languages, but the officers, their number, prerogative, and duties are everywhere identical. The next landmark. The necessity that every lodge, when congregated, should be duly tiled, is an important landmark of the institution which is never neglected. The necessity of this lodge arises from the esoteric character of Masonry. Might I say that again? The necessity to tile a lodge, the necessity for this law arises from the esoteric character of Freemasonry, not the business agenda, my lord. The duty of guarding the door and keeping off cowards and eavesdroppers is an ancient one, which therefore constitutes a landmark. The next landmark. The right of every Mason to be represented in all general meetings of the craft and to instruct his representatives is a 12th landmark. Formerly, these general meetings, which were usually held once a year, were called general assemblies, and all the fraternity, even to the youngest entered apprentice, were permitted to be present. Now they are called grand lodges, and only the master and wardens of the subordinate lodges are summoned. But this is simply as the representatives of their members. Originally, each Mason represented himself. Now he is represented by his officers. I'll only do a couple more today. The right of every Mason, the next landmark, to appeal from the decision of his brethren in lodge convened to the Grand Lodge or Grand Assembly of Masons, is a landmark highly essential to the preservation of justice and the prevention of oppression. Seems a contradiction that we would need laws to preserve justice and prevent oppression in a Masonic lodge. And that says volumes about us. Not proud, but a few modern grand lodges in adopting a regulation that the decision of subordinate lodges in cases of expulsion cannot be wholly set aside upon an appeal have violated this unquestioned landmark, as well as the principles of self-government. The 14th landmark, the right of every Mason to visit and sit in every regular lodge, is an unquestionable landmark of the order. This is called the right of visitation. This right of visitation has always been recognized as an inherent right which inures to every Mason as he travels through the world. And this is because lodges are justly considered as only divisions for convenience of the universal Masonic family. This right may, of course, be impaired or forfeited on special occasions by various circumstances, but when admission is refused to a Mason in good standing who knocks at the door of a lodge as a visitor, it is to be expected that some good and sufficient reason shall be furnished for this violation of what is in general Masonic right founded on the landmarks of the order. And lastly, today, it is a landmark of the order that no visitor unknown to the brethren present or to some one of them as a Mason can enter a lodge without first passing an examination according to ancient usage. Of course, if the visitor is known to any brother present to be a Mason in good standing, and if that brother will vouch for his qualifications, the examination may be dispensed with, as the landmark refers only to the case of strangers who are not to be recognized unless after strict trial, due examination, or lawful information. Okay? Got it? So we'll pick up the next one, a little teaser, a trailer. No lodge can interfere in the business of another lodge, nor give degrees to brethren who are members of other lodges. We'll talk about that next time we see you and get together. Hmm? Interesting stuff, I would say. Eventually we'll get into all of the 44 of the landmarks, and then you can have in your mind whether you think they have merit, whether they should be preserved, how they're preserved. Some are written down, thou shalt. It's just sort of describing the nature of them. Not really a thou shalt, but what do you think? So you've had a little bit of a taste of the order. We're going to move on with a little bit of we can relax just for a bit with Billie Holiday to soothe you. She's an American. She's an American jazz singer. She was born Eleonora Fagan on the 7th of April, 1915. Yeah. She was an American singer. She's known, sometimes you'll hear her known as Lady Day. She lived a very, very interesting life. She was born in Philadelphia, and her father was a musician. And he didn't marry or live with Billy's mom. But not long after she was born, her father left, and her mother, and he became a jazz guitarist. And she moved to Philadelphia at the age of 19 after being kicked out of her family's home for being pregnant. So Holiday was also said to have had Irish ancestors through her mother's mixed heritage. She had a difficult childhood. Her mother often took what were then known as transportation jobs, serving on passenger railroads. And she was left, Billy, to be raised by Eva's mother, her mother's mother-in-law, and suffered from her mother's absence and leaving her in others' care. For the first 10 years of her life, she was sort of passed from pillar to post. And it was in 19... she was off at school. She was caught for truancy. That was back at a time when kids were sent to juvenile court. She was not even 10 years old. Makes you feel real good. Oh, did we get the result we're looking at? Look at us today. She was sent to the House of the Good Shepherd. It was a Catholic reform school. But there, at least she was baptized and she was paroled. Get this, she was there for 9 months. And her mother had come back and opened her, the East Side Grill. And so the little girl went there and she began working long, long hours in it. So at 11 years old, she had dropped out of school. But Billy Holiday returned, Billy's mother returned home on Christmas Eve 1926 and discovered a neighbor, a guy named Wilbur Rich, raping the little girl. Rich was arrested. The officials placed Billy in the House of the Good Shepherd under protective custody as a state witness in the rape case. She was only 11. She found a job when she got out running errands in a brothel, and during this time she first heard the records of Louis Armstrong and Bessie Smith. And by 1929 she went up to Harlem and rejoined her mother. But anyway, you see the tragedy of the life and it begins to make some sense. She wasn't very old when she died. She died in 1959. Yeah. July 17th. Ah, one of those things, one of those tragic characters, sort of like Marilyn Monroe, when we hear about what went on with her. This is one of her tunes, and I think you can pick up the sorrow and the emotion in the voice. In the latter stages of her career, she became more and more outspoken. If she didn't want to show up for a performance, she didn't. If she showed up and she didn't want to sing, she didn't. Who's to say why that was? Thank you. bow, eh? To serve lingers in the ear. One of those little sounds that just makes you feel good. Anyway, Billie Holiday. And we remember her very well, I think. Mind a little bit of chit-chatter about things a little more uplifting, I guess. That'd be okay. We return to the history of the world in six classes, so you can work this into your, you know, show off how much history you know when you're there to Danes and Amaze, your friends and family. I want to address a question. I mean greatest respect to the worshippers of these faiths. This is a question of why Christians drink wine and Muslims do not. Hey, and we'll take this from the history of the world in six glasses. See what you think, whether it compares with your understanding. Marcus Aurelius, it starts off, died in 180 AD, not from poisoning, but from illness. For the last week of his life, he consumed only theoretic and Falernian wine. The end of his reign, a period of relative peace and stability and prosperity, was often taken to mark the end of the golden age of Rome. There followed a succession of short-lived emperors, almost none of whom died of natural causes, and who did their best to defend the empire from the onslaught of barbarians. Now, there's a Christian term, barbarians. That meant not us, really. Everything was bad if it wasn't us. Lying on his deathbed in 395, the emperor Theodosius I divided the empire into western and eastern halves, each to be ruled by one of his sons in an attempt to make it easier to defend. But the western empire soon crumbled. The Visigoths and the Germanic tribes sacked Rome in 410 and then established a kingdom covering much of Spain and western Gaul. Rome was plundered again in 455, 45 years later, by the Vandals. And before long, the Western Empire had been carved up into a multitude of little kingdoms. According to centuries-old Roman and Greek prejudices, the influx of the northern tribes ought to have displaced the civilized wine-drinking culture in favor of beer-drinking barbarism. Yet despite their reputation as vulgar beer lovers, the tribes of northern Europe, where the climate was less suitable to viticulture, had nothing against wine. Of course, many aspects of Roman life were swept away. Trade was disrupted, and the availability of wine in some regions diminished. Romanized Britain seemed to have switched from wine back to beer as the empire crumbled, for example. But there was also cultural confusion between Roman, Christian, and Germanic traditions as new rulers took over from the Romans. One example of continuity was the widespread survival of Mediterranean wine-drinking culture, which was deeply rooted enough to survive the passing of its Greek and Roman parents. The Visigothic law code, for example, drawn up between the 5th and 7th centuries, specified detailed punishments for anyone who damaged a vineyard, hardly what you would expect from barbarians. Another factor in maintaining the wine-drinking culture was its close association with Christianity, the rise of which during the first millennium elevated wine to a position of utmost symbolic significance. According to the Bible, Christ's first miracle at the beginning of his ministry was the transformation of six jars of water into wine at a wedding near the Sea of Galilee. This was in many ways a continuation of the tradition established by members of the cults of Dionysus and his Roman incarnation, Bacchus. The Greek and Roman wine gods, like Christ, were associated with wine-making miracles and resurrection. Their worshippers, like Christians, regarded wine drinking as a form of sacred communion. Yet there are also marked differences. The Christian ritual is nothing like a Dionysian counterpart, and while the former involves very small quantities, the latter calls on large quantities drunk in excess. Although the wine culture remained reasonably intact in Christian Europe, drinking patterns changed dramatically in other parts of the former Roman world as a result of the rise of Islam. Its founder, the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be with him, was born around 570. At the age of 40, he felt himself called to become a prophet and experienced a series of visions during which the Quran was revealed to him by Allah. Muhammad's new teachings made him unpopular in Mecca, a city whose prosperity depended on the traditional Arab religion. So he fled to Medina, where his following grew. By the time of Muhammad's death in 632, Islam had become the dominant faith in most of Arabia. A century later, his adherents had conquered all of Persia, Mesopotamia, Palestine, and Syria, Egypt, and the rest of the northern African coast, and most of Spain. Muslims' duties included frequent prayer, almsgiving, and abstention from alcoholic drinks. Tradition has it that Muhammad's prescription of alcohol followed a fight between two of his disciples during a drinking party. When the Prophet sought divine guidance about how to prevent such incidents, Allah's reply was uncompromising. Wine and games of chance are abominations devised by Satan. Avoid them so that you may prosper. Satan seeks to stir up enmity and hatred among you by means of wine and gambling, and to keep you from remembrance of Allah and from your prayers. Will you not abstain from them? The punishment for anyone who broke this rule was duly set at 40 lashes. It seems likely, however, that the Muslim ban on alcohol was also the result of wider cultural forces. With the rise of Islam, power shifted away from the peoples of the Mediterranean coast and toward the desert tribes of Arabia. These tribes expressed their superiority over the previous elites by replacing wheeled vehicles with camels, chairs, and tables with cushions, and by banning the consumption of wine, that most potent symbol of sophistication. In so doing, Muslims signaled their rejection of the old notions of civilization. Wine's central role in the revival creed of Christianity also predisposed Muslims against it. Even its medical use was banned. After much argument, the prohibition was extended to other alcoholic drinks too. As Islam spread, so did the prohibition of alcohol. The ban on alcohol was, however, enforced more rigorously in some places than in others. Wine was celebrated in the work of Abu Nuwas and other Arab poets, and production continued in Spain and Portugal, for example, even though it was technically illegal. And the fact that Muhammad himself was said to have enjoyed lightly fermented date wine led some Spanish Muslims to argue that his objection was not so much to wine itself as to overindulgence. Makes perfect sense. Only wine made from grapes had been explicitly banned. Presumably on the basis of its strength, therefore, grape wine ought to be allowed, provided it was diluted so that its strength did not exceed that of date wine. This fancy interpretive footwork was controversial, but did provide some leeway. Indeed, wine drinking parties akin to Greek symposia seem to have been popular in some parts of the Muslim world. Mixing wine with water, after all, reduced its potency considerably, and seemed to conform with Muhammad's version of paradise, a garden in which the righteous shall drink of a pure wine tempered with the water of Tasnim, a spring at which the favored will refresh themselves. The advance of Islam into Europe was halted in 732 at the Battle of Tours in central France, where the Arab troops were defeated by Charles Martel, the most charismatic of the princes of the Frankish kingdom, that roughly corresponds with modern France. This battle, one of the turning points in world history, marked the high watermark of Arab influence in Europe. The subsequent crowning of Martel's grandson, Charlemagne, as Holy Roman Emperor in 800 heralded the start of a period of consolidation and eventual reinvigoration of European culture. So, a little bit about the history and the wise, in the wise, I think. We I'm going to wrap up today. It's been really nice to have this opportunity. Thank you very much for joining me. But all good things come to an end, only to be replaced by better things. All friendships come to an end, only to be replaced by better things, better friends. The experiences that we had yesterday are replaced by the experiences and excitement of tomorrow. The newness and freshness of them, well, that depends on you. That depends on you. If you hear yourself walking around complaining that that you're bored, the world is not exactly going to fall to your feet and come up with something to excite you. That boredom is going to continue as long as you cling and hang on to it. The world is a very exciting place, and there's opportunity continuously. Just look for it, and you'll find it. If you are feeling out of sorts, force that feeling out of your mind. Focus on, put a smile on your face and focus on the simple things around you. Remember, there's big picture always going on. But our contribution is at a small level, what you do with yourself and with others. Be productive today. I hope the great architect of the universe watches over you and you enjoy the benefits of being a Freemason, that sense of satisfaction that occurs from doing things for other people. I'm going to play us out of here today with a little bit of klezmer music, just because I just find it... you'll find this interesting. It's like Perlman, and he's playing klezmer. Okay? I think you'll like it. He joins the group. It's four. I think you'll like it. See what you think. a little Canadian, Natalie McMaster. See you later.
Thank you. Well, we're going to play one together now. We're laughing, like, because our styles are totally different, as you can hear. And so, Janelle and I are actually in the process of writing new pieces of music together that we can play, but we don't have any of those ready. We just started yesterday. So we're going to play something together anyway.
With 1 minute.
The running late dance pass. We've got another 10 minutes.
We're going to play a tune, and Natalie's going to accompany me on the piano. The Cape Breton piano playing is just awesome. it's very rhythmic, and it's you'll see it. My mom plays piano, and she learned to play before they had a piano at home in Cape Breton. Before mom's family had a piano in Cape Breton, she learned to play the rhythms on a piece of board, and the fiddlers would all congregate to play on the cold winter's evenings, and mom would be banging on this board. So when they bought a piano, they bought it in Toronto and had it taken by train and brought in on a horse and sleigh to the house, it became the only piano in the region. And mom said she could basically play, as soon as the piano arrived, she could play it because she had learned all these rhythms. Anyway, we found the piano last year and were able to bring it back home. We purchased it. It had gone through like five or six families, and it was just a big thing for us. And we found actually an old picture of somebody in their family years ago. Anyway, I'm blabbering on here.
What about Leahy?
She wants to talk about. We have a band named Leahy. There's 11 siblings. We what will I tell them? We opened. We were on. No surgeries. Oh yeah. We had a great opportunity. We opened for Shania Twain for 2 years on her international tour. It was a big thing for us, and now all my sisters are off having babies, and the boys are all getting married. So we're staying close to home for I guess another couple of weeks. What can I say? I don't know what to say, Natalie. We
is this what marriage is about? I like it.
Oh yeah, okay. In our family, we had 7 girls, 4 boys. We had 2 fiddles and 1 piano, and of course, we were all fighting to play on the instruments. So Dad and Mom set a rule that you couldn't kick anyone off the instrument. You had to wait till they were finished. So of course, what we'd do is we'd get on the piano and you wouldn't even get off to eat because you wouldn't want to give it up to your brother or sister, and they'd wait and wait and wait, and it'd be midnight and you'd be still sitting there on the piano, but it was their way to get us to practice. Will we play a tune? It worked. Okay, sorry, I hate to hear it. So this is our last number, and we'll feature Nat and piano. Okay, playing in How About Dave? Thank you.
Thank you.